the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. So we're looking at the bad trait of hastiness. So obviously the answer is, how do we control things when it comes to us jumping to straight arguments and straight judging and what have you, just being in that mental state of trying to do everything quickly and, you know, without having to hit the brakes. One of the methods is that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given me and you is the notion or the concept of patience. A mu'min always need to be patient. And patience means that you hold yourself, you compose yourself, you wait, you understand, you think. Because patience is not just a concept that you throw around. It's a concept that you need to apply. So we're having an argument, me and you, and I'm trying to convey something to you, but you just jump into conclusion and then you accuse me, or I do the same. You know, patience means that I hold my anger, I hold my temptations, I hold my urge to talk, whatever that needs to be done or I feel like doing at the moment, I pause on it. This is what we call patience. So patience is one of the things that need to be done and taken into consideration. Another thing that we can do is we can have what we call a 1 minute delay. 1 minute delay method means that every time you want to do something or say something, pause. Say to yourself, I will answer, I will reply, I will do this action, but after a minute. In that minute, give yourself time to think of what happened, what is happening, and what is the best way to deal with. Without just jumping and, you know, going with the urge to talk and speak your mind. So obviously this is always something that we should not indulge in. So we are always, when we give ourselves that 1 minute break, when we think about it, we can come up with a better answer, a better reply, and a better action. That's the idea. So you can apply a 1 minute rule. You can make it 2. The more you give it time, the better. It says that one of the mystics and one of the scholars that we have, I don't want to mention his name, that when they ask him a question, he never replies. He would pause. And actually first he would say, Allahu A'lam, God knows. And then he would pause for a while. And he would think. And then he would give the answer. And the answer is precisely is the correct answer. He could have just said it. But he started to think himself, what if I'm wrong? What is the best way to deliver this answer? What is the best thing to say? And he thinks it through, and then he talks. This is what a wise, logical man needs to do. And this is something that me and you, we can do as well. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم.
In the limelight.
The biggest economy in Europe is facing zero growth. A new study has found that energy and raw materials prices, along with a shortage of skilled workers, pose major threats to the German economy. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Bloomberg reported the German business community has little optimism about growth prospects in the EU's largest economy, citing a study conducted by the Association of German Chambers of Industry and Commerce, DIHK. After two quarters of zero growth, respondents from 21,000 companies that took part in the survey said there were little signs of improvement in the economic environment. Despite the resilience that German companies have shown during the month of soaring energy prices and rising interest rates, the outlook for the next 12 months remains murky, especially since incoming orders are noticeably decreasing on the demand side, DIHK CEO Ilja Nottangel said in a statement. Researchers at the DIHK maintained a forecast of zero growth in Germany this year, although more pessimistic than 0.2% expansion expected by the European Commission, it matches a recent outlook put out by the International Monetary Fund. Last week, IMF issued a forecast saying German GDP growth will stay near zero in 2023 before gradually strengthening to 1% to 2% during 2024 to 2026 as the lagged effects of monetary tightening gradually dissipate and the economy adjusts to the energy shock. Economists are predicting that German industry will remain at a standstill instead of the hoped-for recovery, dampening prospects of an economic resurgence. The DIHK survey has highlighted prices of energy and raw materials as the biggest threat facing German businesses, while a lack of qualified workers was seen as a major structural challenge for companies in the future. Also, RT noted inflation in the euro area increased for the first time in 5 months in April, surging to 7%. The European Union's statistics office reported recently confirming preliminary data. Eurostat said consumer prices had risen from 6.9% in March as higher services and energy costs offset a slowdown in food price growth. Services inflation, which is primarily driven by labor costs, accelerated to 5.2% in April from 5.1% in the previous month. Energy prices were up again after a slight decline in March. Food, tobacco prices were also up by 2.75% last month, but were lower than 3.12% rise in March. According to the report, core inflation, excluding food and energy prices, slowed to 7.3% from 7.5%, while an even narrower measure, which excludes tobacco, declined from 5.7% to 5.6%. Eurostat data showed that Latvia continued to struggle with the highest inflation at 15%, followed by Slovakia, Lithuania and Estonia, all dealing with a double-digit surge in consumer prices among the 20-member Eurozone. Inflation in the single currency area has been above the European Central Bank's ECB 2% target for nearly 2 years, with the regulator repeating hiking rates since last July to curb double-digit growth in consumer prices. The ECB once again increased rates recently to 3.25% and has promised another hike at its next meeting in June. Reuters also reported Eurozone inflation accelerated last month. Eurostat said recently, confirming preliminary data pointing to increasingly stubborn price growth among the 20 nations sharing the euro. Overall price growth accelerated to 7% in April from 6.9% a month earlier, as rising services and energy costs offset a slowdown in food price growth. Although underlying price growth, the key focus of European Central Bank policymakers in recent months, slowed a touch, the crucial services component continued to accelerate, pointing to mounting wage pressures that could get inflation stuck above the ECB's 2% target. Excluding volatile food and fuel prices, core inflation slowed to 7.3% from 7.5%, while an even narrower measure, which excludes tobacco, slowed to 5.6% from 5.7% in its first decline since last June. Inflation has been above the ECB's 2% target for nearly 2 years, and the bank has lifted interest rates by a combined 375 basis points since last July to arrest runaway price growth. But more hikes are likely, as it could be 2025 before inflation is back at target, and the last mile of disinflation getting from 3% to 2% could be especially difficult, taking nearly 2 years. Reuters added services inflation, which is primarily driven by labor costs, accelerated to 5.2% from 5.1%, confirming policymaker fears that nominal wage growth could become dangerously fast. Wages are still down in real terms given rapid inflation, but low unemployment and growing labor scarcity, especially in services, is driving up nominal wages. The ECB has long said that nominal wage growth of 3% would be consistent with its inflation target, but this year's rise could be twice as fast. Unexpectedly generous wage deals in Germany, the bloc's biggest economy, also raised the risk that labor costs could continue to rise, especially quickly next year, prolonging inflation. Markets see the ECB's 3.25% deposit rate rising to just below 3.75% this summer, but some policymakers have already warned that this may not be enough.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear listeners, Salamun Alaikum. You're listening to this program, Lantern. We have a nice story to hear and learn about it. So let's listen. What's the title of today's story? The Farmer and the Well. A farmer looking for a source of water for his farm bought a well from his neighbor. The neighbor was cunning, though, and refused to let the farmer take water from the well. On asking why, he replied, "I sold the well to you, not the water," and walked away. The distraught farmer didn't know what to do, so he went to Birbali, a clever man and one of the nine countries of Emperor Akbar, for a solution. The emperor called the farmer and his neighbor and asked why the man was not letting the farmer draw water from the well. The cunning man said the same thing again. "I sold the well, not the water, so I cannot take my water." To this, Birbal replied, "All that sounds fine to me, but if you have sold the water and the water is yours, then you have no business keeping your water in his well. Remove the water or use it all up immediately. If not, the water will belong to the owner of the well." Realizing that he is being tricked and taught his lesson, the man apologized and left. Moral point: cheating will not get you anything. If you do cheat, you'll pay for it soon enough. So take care. Now we'll listen to the interpretation and explanation of this interesting story.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, in our today's show, we are going to talk about the cheating and cheating and deceit in our life, and in general, what we need to know about cheating and deceit. The Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, "Whoever deceives another Muslim or harms him or even dislikes him is not one of us." Deceiving is strictly forbidden, dear brothers and sisters. Like other acts, it harms others as well as the deceiver. How cheated you feel and how you complain if you buy food and then discover that it is bad and the seller has deceived you and has benefited himself at your expense. How cheated you feel and how you complain if your watch is broken and you take it to a watchmaker to repair, but he deceives you about fixing it, and after a few days it breaks down again and it breaks down again with the same fault. Indeed, you feel that these people are mischievous and troublesome and have misled you by taking your money in an unlawful way and by deceiving you and causing annoyance to you. You have the right to return the bad food to the one who cheated you and get your money back. And you have the right to return the watch to the watchmaker to repair it again, because both try to deceive you. Surely deceiving is an unlawful and immoral deed. So believers never do it. Among our Islamic morals is to advise others, both in speech and action, on what is correct. Thus, if one of us does something or carries out a task, it is obligatory for him to do it. It is obligatory for him to do it with sincerity and without deceiving people. If someone asks for advice, a believer should advise him truly without deceiving him. Surely the Holy Messenger sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, "He who deceives Muslims is incomplete in belief and is not one of us." Causing harm also is forbidden, not only cheating. As the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam warned us against deceiving people through this hadith, he also warned us against any deed which causes harm and hurts others. Whoever causes harm to others intentionally is not a believer. So it is obligatory for a believer to indemnify people for any harm caused by him to them. The lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
The farmer who prevents water from reaching other farmers in order to destroy their crops is surely a destructive man who deliberately wants to cause harm. Whoever deliberately damages a footpath indeed causes harm to other people. These acts and others like them are intentionally damaging and cause destruction to society. A faithful should avoid doing anything which harms others. A Muslim is a useful Muslim who does good actions, tries to benefit others, and never thinks of just himself. Again, in addition to deceiving and harming people, also cunning is forbidden. Indeed, the Islamic religion wants a Muslim to deal with people in a straight manner, not to deceive or cheat them. Indeed, neither the cheater nor the deceiver are believers. Among the examples of deceiving is the way some traders behave in order to cheat each other, such as one who goes to another trader and tells him, "Surely this product is no good. It's no good, so do not buy it." He says this so that no one competes with him in buying that product. And if others listen to him, he can buy it in order to obtain maximum profits for himself. Verily, this act of cunning and the like are forbidden, as it is a form of deceiving, which a Muslim with true belief never does. Indeed, a Muslim does not cheat another Muslim, nor does, and also no Muslim does the act of cunning on anyone else, be it a Muslim or non-Muslim. So what we learned, dear brothers and sisters, in this show, cheating, harming, and any act of cunning is forbidden in Islam, and all of them are interrelated. And a Muslim is far from any of these bad actions and bad deeds. Till our next show, I'll leave in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
I was so far from you, yet to me you were always so close. I wandered lost in the dark. I closed my eyes to all the signs you put in my way.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding.
IRIB English Radio.
This is
a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. This is For a Better Life from IRB English Radio. I am your host, Sayyid Mahdi Tawakkul. This discussion is related to Islamic lifestyle and is based on the Quran and Islamic narrations. Today I want to talk about a new topic, which is that a person should try to create harmony between his hidden inner and his outer expression. Let me explain it. What I mean is that under normal circumstances, a person should not hide something in his heart and then be forced to behave contrary to that. If we have a kind of feeling that bothers us in normal situations, we can share it with others. Not letting others understand our emotions forces us not to behave normally, and we should pretend that we are satisfied with everything while we are not. Trying to behave in a way that is contrary to what we have in our heart makes the life more difficult, because we always have to play a role. For example, we might be angry with someone or upset with someone, but due to some circumstances, we may prefer not to say anything directly to that person, to tell him about our anger and our disturbance. In such cases, people who conceal something in their heart try to play roles when they are with those people. They force themselves to smile while they are angry, try to keep their composure while they are impatient. Such cases take place so much in our life. We come across with many situations that we hide something within ourselves and does not reveal it to others, but for not revealing it, we put ourselves in trouble. Because in this situation, we should be always watchful and careful not to act abnormally. It not only adds to your discomfort, but also hiding an intense negative emotion usually makes it more intense and more rigorous. But if we share to others, but of course in a controlled way, we would find out that it was solved much easier than we had thought before. The mistake is that in this way that we try to hide our inner feelings, suddenly and unconsciously reveal it through our words or through our behavior. As an instance, if you hate someone too much but don't want him to realize it, you may suddenly criticize him, or maybe do not honor him as you should. Do not listen to his words while he is talking. Do not answer his call. Do not invite him to your house, or to do whatever of things that if he is clever and intelligent, may realize that something is wrong here. So when we cannot control ourselves, we had better be honest to others. We had better not to play roles that much in life. Sometimes we need to be real. We need to act normally and to behave in an ordinary way. Of course, I don't want to say that we have to reveal our inner feeling to everyone, or for example, tell someone that we hate him or are angry with him, dislike one of his manners and the like. Not at all, because telling others about our feelings towards them may bring enmity. Rather, I want to say that we should not be like an actor and actress in our life, to mostly play a role and to show something that is in contradiction with our reality. If you do this, I mean, if you are not real and to usually try to play a role, it has two disadvantages. Number one, we instead of being real and act normally, have to mostly play a role, and it adds too much disturbance in our life. It makes the life very uncomfortable. Number two, if we are not real, many mistakes would appear in our words and in our treatment that would unveil our inner feeling. It could be deeply disturbing if we try to play a role and not to be successful. Or in other words, to bother ourselves to hide our feeling and in addition not to be successful and involuntarily reveal our feelings. Because of these two undesirable results, we had better try to be always real, try to act in a normal way, unless we find it necessary to hide something. Let's go for a short break. I am Said Mehdi Tavakkol, and I will be back soon to talk about other related points to this subject. I was talking about the importance of having a real life and the bad effect not to be real and play roles all the time. People who play roles in their life and hide their true nature psychologically want to keep others satisfied. These people want to show that everything is just fine, there is nothing to disturb them, and to be 100% sure that those who are with them are totally happy with them. These people are so cautious in their speech and in their behavior that they make life very difficult for themselves. As I said, to some extent we have to hide our inner feeling and should not reveal it, but if this kind of behavior becomes a part of our life, it is absolutely problematic. People are never 100% satisfied with others. So even if we try our best to make others happy with ourselves, there are still many things in us that others don't like. So it's better not to always play roles. Imam Ali in a meaningful narration says, مَا أَضْمَرَ أَحَدٌ شَيْئًا إِلَّا ظَهَرَ فِي فَلَتَاتِ لِسَانِهِ وَصَفَحَاتِ وَجْهِهِ. There is no person who conceals a thing in his heart that it manifests itself through unintentional words from his tongue and in the expression of his face. This narration alludes to some points. First, do not bother yourselves to act contrary to your feeling, because you cannot be always successful, since the inner feeling will manifest itself while you are not aware. Second, playing role and trying to show always smiling lip makes life unreal and causes too much disturbance and brings about anxiety, and it would become a big concern in one's life. So do not be strict on yourself and do not try to always make others satisfied with yourself. Since even if you try to make others happy with yourselves, you cannot succeed. The third point, which is very important, is that Imam Ali, in this mentioned narration, wants to say that even if you feel bad about someone, try to correct it yourself. Pay attention to this crucial point. Sometimes we hold someone's grudge in our heart. Sometimes we dislike someone's behavior. We want to criticize someone, or we hate someone. Having these negative feelings about other people is usually negated in Islam. If our heart is full of these negative emotions, this source of negative attitudes about others, we will reveal it unintentionally. So we had better realize that others are normal people like us. They have their own mistakes, their own vision, their own taste, and their own perspective. We are not all the same. We are different, and being different is a part of our life. then it should never lead to garouj, enmity and hatred. Again, I need to repeat and remind the fact that what I am saying so far is a general principle in life, and it of course has some exceptions. Sometimes we should not conceal our feeling about others, we have to reveal it. Sometimes we need to pretend we are happy while we are not. Sometimes we have to play a role, but these are exceptions. As a result, the wise man can study the condition and decide which strategy is more appropriate to be adapted. And whatever we do should be something that makes us closer to the will of Allah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A new report has shed light on the covert military operations of the UK's army around the world. The report by The Guardian says Britain's special forces have carried out secret operations in 19 countries over the past 12 years. Countries where British forces involved in included Nigeria, the Philippines, and Russia, as well as in Syria, Ukraine, and most recently Sudan. 11 out of the 19 countries where UK special forces operated secretly were Muslim nations. The elite military units operate in secret without ministers publicly confirming their activities. But a research group, Action on Armed Violence, has compiled a list of their activities since the year 2011, based on media leaks. It says the members of the Special Air Force, Special Boat Service, and Special Reconnaissance Regiment were repeatedly deployed by the Prime Minister and Defense Secretary to conduct high-risk missions, typically where the UK is not at war. Special forces were particularly active in Syria. They reportedly entered the country in 2012 to help anti-Damascus groups fight against President Bashar al-Assad. Reports say that they were also sent to Syria in 2013 to identify military targets in advance of a bombing campaign which was to be conducted by the UK. That bombing campaign was vetoed by members of the parliament.
Senior defense sources have told Newsnight that Britain did, in fact, have a secret plan for intervening in Syria. It was the brainchild of General David Richards, Britain's most senior officer, who told Downing Street there were only two ways of ending the bloodshed quickly. The first was to let Assad win. The second was to defeat him. To defeat him, he recommended training and equipping a substantial army of Syrian rebels.
In Ukraine, the Pentagon documents leaked earlier this year showed that 50 members of UK special forces were in the former Soviet Republic, alongside Kiev forces fighting against Russia. By contrast, the numbers from the U.S. and France were listed as 14 and 15, respectively.
The United Kingdom has unlocked a number of packages in the last year. We're going further. Beginning of this week, I announced to Parliament that we will send a squadron of Challenger 2 main battle tanks to Ukraine. We will send at least three batteries of AS-90 155 long-range deep-fire artillery. We will send a number of armoured vehicles, including the, I think it's the Bulldog, which is a variant of the old 432 armoured personnel carrier, thousands of rounds of ammunition. And today I can say we're also going to send another 600 Brimstone missiles into theatre, which will be incredibly important in helping Ukraine dominate the battlefield.
The report further said the deployments depict a lack of insight by Parliament. While MPs have to vote for a war, special forces can be deployed without Commons approval, and their actions are not subject to investigation by any parliamentary committee. Major military acts of war conducted by UK special forces must be approved by the British Parliament. However, small-scale special forces operations can be carried out without MPs' permission and are not subject to committee investigations. The revelation comes at the heels of earlier reports that special British forces killed innocent civilians in Afghanistan. In March this year, a public inquiry began into allegations that the SAS were responsible for 54 summary killings in Afghanistan in 2010 and 2011, typically on night raids. Men were separated from their families and reportedly shot dead after being said to have produced a weapon.
Quite frankly, now the infantry regiments are doing exactly what they're paid for, certainly since the invasion of Iraq and obviously the operations now in Afghanistan. So therefore, a lot of soldiers are looking at their prospects of going to the Special Air Service for action to get involved in operations. And they say, you know what? I'm doing it already.
Senior military officers have been accused of bearing evidence that British troops were executing detainees in Afghanistan. Apart from Afghanistan, Britain followed Washington's lead against Iraq in 2003. The aggression killed thousands of Iraqis. Meanwhile, the UK policy, detailed, has mandated the military to increase its secret operations in other countries to protect Britain's interests across the globe. The doctrine requires a shift in focus for the future in order to counter Russia and China.
Britain's former Prime Minister has made a controversial trip to the US state of Texas to shore up support for Ukraine. The Center for European Policy Analysis, or the CEPA, a pro-Ukrainian think tank based in Washington, decided to enlist Johnson to push Republicans to support Ukraine. Pro-Ukraine think tankers brought Johnson to a private lunch in Dallas, Texas, to meet two dozen of the state's leading conservative figures, including politicians, donors, and captains of the industry. Johnson's Dallas trip included a visit with former President George W. Bush, in which the two talked about the war in Ukraine. The former UK Prime Minister flew to Texas as a growing number of conservative lawmakers, candidates, and activists have started to question the size of the US support package for Ukraine. Johnson has been enlisted because he is said to have been very much seen as the architect of the Western policy on Ukraine. Johnson was a staunch backer of the West's proxy war with Russia during his time in office. He also played a crucial role in ditching peace talks that was held in the early days of the conflict. In April 2022, then Prime Minister Johnson traveled to Kiev and urged Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to stop negotiating with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Johnson's visit to the U.S. comes amid the backdrop of rising tensions between Russia and Ukraine's Western supporters. Russia has warned that supplying more destructive and advanced weapons by the U.S. and its allies to Ukraine increases the probability of a nuclear apocalypse. Russia's former president Dmitry Medvedev, who is currently serving as deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, has said that the more weapons are supplied, the more dangerous the world will be. Earlier this month, the United Kingdom announced during a summit of European leaders that it was working with the Netherlands to build a so-called international jet coalition to help Ukraine obtain F-16 fighter jets from its mostly Western allies.
So apparently they believe that a nuclear conflict or a nuclear apocalypse is impossible because it is never possible. They are wrong. And at some point, events can go completely according to an unpredictable scenario, and the responsibility will lie entirely with the North Atlantic Alliance.
Medvedev's warning came days after American President Joe Biden told fellow G7 leaders in Japan that he supported a joint effort with allies to train Ukrainian pilots on F-16 fighter jets. The U.S. has so far committed $48 billion U.S. dollars in military aid and other assistance to Ukraine since the beginning of the war. Washington is the biggest supplier of weaponry to the Ukrainian military. Meanwhile, Russia says it conducted an operation in the border city of Belgorod after Ukraine-based militants staged a sabotage raid there. Russia has said more than 70 attackers were killed in its operation to repel cross-border raiders who entered the country's Belgorod region.
On May 22nd, a unit of the Ukrainian Nationalist Formation invaded the territory of the Russian Federation in the area of the international checkpoint in the Belgorod region. In the course of the counter-terrorist operation, the Nationalist Formations were blocked and defeated by airstrikes, artillery fire, and the active actions of the Western Military District units covering the state border. The remaining Nationalists were driven back to the territory of Ukraine, where they were completely eliminated. More than 70 Ukrainian terrorists were eliminated, as well as machinery and armored vehicles.
Russia says the cross-border sabotage was aimed to divert attention away from Bakhmut and minimize Ukraine's losses in the eastern city, which Russian troops claim to have fully captured. The battle over the city has been described as the heaviest to take place between the Russian and Ukrainian forces since last February.
Papua New Guinea has signed a defense and maritime cooperation agreement with the U.S. during the U.S. Pacific Islands Forum in Port Moresby. The agreement was signed by Defense Minister Win Bakridaki and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who flew into the country early on Monday in the place of U.S. President Joe Biden. In a meeting with PNG Prime Minister James Morope during the signing ceremony, Blinken said the United States would deepen its partnership across the board with the country.
The Defense Cooperation Agreement, drafted by Papua New Guinea and the United States as equal and sovereign partners, will enhance the PNG's Defense Forces capabilities to deliver humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, including through providing medical care and temporary shelter to those who are affected by crises.
Morope, for his part, hailed the deal as a mutually beneficial agreement.
Both sides have agreed that the agreement that we're signing today is doesn't offend Papua New Guinea law, doesn't offend USA law. It's mutually beneficial, especially and for me in the context of Papua New Guinea. It secures our national interest to grow into becoming a robust economy in this part of the world as we live today and going forward.
PNG's Prime Minister, James Morope, said that to implement the deal, there would be an increased presence of U.S. military personnel and contractors over the next 2 years. However, he insisted that the Americans will not establish a U.S. military base on the island. Morope also denied reports that U.S. staff would have legal immunity and said no amendments would be made to the Constitution or laws of the country. That's after a leaked draft document suggested Port Moresby has given U.S. personnel and contractors legal immunity, allowing aircrafts, vehicles, and vessels operated by or on behalf of the U.S. to move freely within its territory and territorial waters, and exemptions for U.S. staff from all migration requirements. The U.S. State Department announced the new pact covers security, defense, and maritime surveillance and would provide $45 million to help improve bilateral cooperation, including protective equipment for the Papua New Guinea Defense Force. PNG, with a population of nearly 10 million people, is the most populous Pacific Island nation located just north of Australia. The region has witnessed increasing militarization in past years, raising concerns among civil society groups. They accuse Morope of setting the stage for future hostilities between the U.S. and China. PNG's former Prime Minister Peter O'Neill accused his successor of placing the country at the epicenter of a military storm between China and the U.S. by agreeing to enter into defense agreements with both superpowers without consultation with people. Also, opposition leader Joseph Lelang from the People's National Congress said last week we should not be blinded by the dollar sign or be coerced into signing deals that may be detrimental to us in the long run. He said the foreign policy of Papua New Guinea is friends to all and enemies to none. In the midst of growing rivalry between Washington and Beijing in the Pacific region, China has warned against geopolitical games in the South Pacific after the U.S. signed a security agreement with Papua New Guinea.
What we must be vigilant about is the use of cooperation as a pretext for engaging in geopolitical games, and we believe no cooperation should target third parties.
The foreign ministry spokesperson, however, stressed that China has no objection to normal exchanges and equal, mutually beneficial cooperation with Pacific Island nations, including Papua New Guinea. She said any negotiation and cooperation agreement should benefit regional peace, development, and stability. The Pacific nations manage around 20% of the world's oceans. These hugely important maritime routes were used in World War II to transport supplies to Australia and New Zealand. Western interests in the Pacific waned after the war, but Chinese investments in the region have grown. Beijing has worked to strengthen ties with several island nations over the last decade, sending aid and investing in schools, roads, and bridges. However, in recent years, the U.S. has been expanding its military presence in the Pacific as part of its strategic shift to East Asia, where it seeks to contain the growing power of China.
Mission accomplished. Iranian Navy's 86th flotilla has wrapped up its 8-month voyage and returned home. The flotilla, comprised of domestically manufactured Dena destroyer and Macron forward base ship, arrived at the southern port city of Bandar Abbas on Saturday. The naval fleet set sail on a mission around the world from Bandar Abbas in September 2022. The flotilla stopped at the port of Mumbai, India, and then docked in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, after passing through the Bay of Bengal and the Strait of Malacca. The fleet continued its journey towards the Java Sea and passed through the Strait of Makassar, arriving in the vast Pacific Ocean for the first time in the history of Iran's military seafaring. Crossing the Pacific Ocean, the fleet moved toward the Strait of Magellan in the south of the Americas and entered the South Atlantic Ocean. The naval squadron also passed the coasts of Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, and finally anchoring in the port of Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. The flotilla then crossed the Atlantic Ocean and anchored in the city of Cape Town, South Africa. It then berthed in the coasts of Oman and finally sailed into the Iranian territorial waters. An official ceremony was held in Bandar Abbas to welcome the arrival of the naval fleet. Addressing the official homecoming ceremony of the flotilla, the Chief of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces said the arrival of the 86th Naval Flotilla is a source of pride for the Iranian nation and a landmark accomplishment in the history of the country's naval missions. Major General Mohammad Hossein Bagheri said the flotilla concluded its historic voyage on the high seas to mark what he called an outstanding achievement despite Western-led sanctions against the Islamic Republic. General Bagheri said maritime prowess is among the most important factors of Iran's military might. He added, "We do not lack anything to achieve such an ideal and are gifted with homegrown industries for that purpose." He noted that the Iranian courageous commanders and marines undertake naval missions valiantly and fearlessly. The arrival of the naval fleet to Bandar Abbas comes as the unprecedented move of the Iranian Navy in carrying out such difficult missions ushers in a new era for the Iranian armed forces. As Major General Bagheri put it, the 86th flotilla of the Navy fulfilled a historic mission. Even major countries in the world do not have the courage to undertake such a task. What makes a round-the-world mission significant, though, is the way Western countries, namely the United States, reacted to it. In February, the U.S. Treasury sanctioned the two ships while they were on the international voyage. According to Iranian officials, the U.S. has also failed to prevent the Iranian naval flotilla from sailing through the Panama Canal, an 82-kilometer waterway in Panama that connects the Atlantic Pacific Oceans. Iran's Navy commander, Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, has said, quote, the global arrogance tried to block the Iranian flotilla's mission through threats and sanctions, but the successful voyage marked another slap in their faces. The Navy commander also said that France claimed that the Iranian ships had entered its waters, but they changed course when they were reminded of their own shipping rules and regulations. All those reactions highlight Iran's naval prowess in international waters. In recent years, naval forces of the Islamic Republic have enhanced their presence throughout global waters to protect shipping routes and provide security for merchant vessels and tankers. The Iranian Navy has also regularly carried out patrols in the Gulf of Aden and the Indian Ocean to fight piracy in an effort to secure vessels commuting in international waters. Not to mention that numerous attacks on Iranian or foreign vessels have been thwarted by the Iranian Navy in recent years. All in all, the unprecedented voyage by the 86th Flotilla not only has shown Iran's maritime capabilities, but drove home the point that the language of threat and force does not work with Iran, as it is committed to asserting its strength in international waters and providing security to its vessels.
In the limelight.
The oathkeeper's founder, Stuart Rhodes, who said after the Capitol attack that the rioters should have brought rifles with them, received the longest sentence of any January 6th defendant to date. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The cable broadcaster CNN Cable News Network has covered the story and tells us more. Stuart Rhodes, the founder and leader of the Oath Keepers, was sentenced to 18 years in prison on Thursday, 25th of May, for leading a far-reaching plot to keep then-President Donald Trump in power after he lost the 2020 election. A second Oath Keepers member, Kelly Meggs, the leader of the Florida contingent of the group, was sentenced to 12 years in prison. The sentences are the first handed down in over a decade for seditious conspiracy. What we absolutely cannot have is a group of citizens who, because they did not like the outcome of an election, who did not believe the law was followed as it should be, foment revolution, District Judge Amit Mehta said before handing down the sentence. That is what you did. I dare say, Mr. Rhodes, and I never have said this to anyone I have sentenced, you pose an ongoing threat and peril to our democracy and the fabric of this country, District Judge Mehta said. The judge added, I dare say we all now hold our collective breaths when an election is approaching. Will we have another January 6 again? That remains to be seen. Judge Mehta said, Stuart Rhodes, 58 years old, has expressed no remorse and continues to be a threat. A seditious conspiracy, when you take those two concepts and put it together, is among the most serious crimes an American can commit, the judge said. It's an offense against the government to use force. It's an offense against the people of our country. Earlier on Thursday, District Judge Amit Mehta ruled that Stuart Rhodes's actions amounted to domestic terrorism. He was the one giving the orders, Judge Mehta said. He was the one organizing the teams on that day. He was the reason they were, in fact, in Washington, D.C. Oath Keepers wouldn't have been there but for Stuart Rhodes. I don't think anyone contends otherwise. He was the one who gave the order to go, and they went. Rhodes was convicted of seditious conspiracy by a Washington, D.C. jury back in November. in a historic criminal trial that was a test of the Justice Department's ability to hold January 6 rioters accountable and validated prosecutors' arguments that the breach of the Capitol was a grave threat to American democracy. The seditious conspiracy charge has rarely been brought in the century and a half that the statute and its forerunners have been on the books. U.S. Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn, who testified earlier this week about his experience on 6th of January 2021, told CNN that Donald Trump should be next. "It is a step towards full accountability," Harry Dunn said. His lawyers argued that Donald Trump is the root of the problem, and I totally agree.